You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Local farmers' markets are overflowing with fruits, vegetables, and flowers, but how is your garden growing? If you're worried that your hydrangeas may not survive the summer heat, or if you're having difficulty keeping hungry insects off of your ripe tomatoes, well, help is on the way, because joining me now to answer all of your green thumb questions is horticulturist Gerard Lourdal, director of the Open Space Greening Program for the Council on the Environment of New York City, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to the show. Hi, Gerard.
Hi, Leonard. Good to be here.
And before we get going, I'm going to give out the phone number, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. You can also post your questions and comments online at our show page at WNYC.org. Has this been a particularly hot summer, Gerard?
It's been rough, and a lot of the community gardeners and general backyard gardeners are very anxious to, maybe improve on their mulching in the garden. That's one thing I think a lot of the gardeners are regretting, not mulching heavily. You're out in 90-degree weather in your community garden or your backyard garden. You've got a lot of weeds coming up. Your soil's drying out really fast. That brings on stress to your vegetables and flowers and causes diseases and insects. So a lot of people are regretting not mulching more with this heat. Then we had a lot of rain back when, and that caused their own problems. You get a lot of powdery mildew diseases. There's a problem with tomatoes. Sometimes if you have a very dry period, a dry spell, it pulls the calcium out of the soil, and then you get what's called blossom end rot. And many gardeners are experiencing that from those dry spells.
So we had a lot of rain, and then we had dry spells. It's been a very odd summer. On top of it all, it's been pretty hot.
It's been really hot. And I just want to caution your listeners, if you're outdoors, make sure you drink a lot of water. Make sure you wear a hat, put sunscreen on, and watch out for poison ivy. It's
really
everywhere, it seems.
Well, if we go through a dry spell, then we water, don't we? Are there certain ways to water? For example, if it were tomatoes.
Right.
Is it possible that I could overwater my tomatoes?
Well, the issue is many times gardeners are not doing enough of a thorough watering. You think that, you're rushed. We're all very busy with work and job and family. So you give a little shot of water to your tomatoes and you think that's sufficient. It actually has to be a thorough drenching so that the roots can be thoroughly moistened 6 inches down below the soil. And that's what will benefit the plants the most.
The equivalent of a hard rain.
That's right. Yeah. So just wetting the leaves and letting the water glisten and you feel good about that is not the right way to water. Mulching, when you put wood chip or lawn clippings or even shredded newspaper on top of the soil, that actually prevents the weeds, keeps the soil moist, and tempers the soil.
Are there better times of day to do the watering?
It's recommended you water in the morning. Not a good idea to water in the evening. The reason is because that gives an opportunity for a lot of diseases in the coolness of the evening when it's wet. A lot of diseases love that kind of an environment. So water in the early morning before you go to work or before you have your lunch.
We've often talked about when to plant, and I assume that pretty much all the things that are in the ground now should have been planted. But are there some plants that can go in now to blossom later?
And I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of gardeners don't realize that August is the month to sow a lot of seeds of vegetables that could give you a second harvest. All those crops that like the cool temperature in the early spring, like Swiss chard and lettuce and kohlrabi and kale and collards, you could plant them again in August for a fall harvest, because they're tolerant of the cool fall temperature, and you could be harvesting into early December.
But can you really grow lettuce and kohlrabi in a typical New York backyard?
Absolutely. The community gardens, there are over 600 community gardens that are registered with the Parks Department under Green Thumb, and they grow an amazing amount of vegetables. We have 14 teenagers working with us this summer in the Bronx. They're growing 20 different types of vegetables. It's called Learn It, Eat It, Grow It. And it's teaching kids about proper nutrition. I mean, you could grow almost every kind of vegetable during the season.
But not in window boxes or planters.
You're right. You're limited with window boxes. But if you take a walk through the Union Square Green Market, you'll see wonderful varieties of short carrots or small beets, French breakfast beets, and the Nantes carrots, and the patio tomatoes can be grown in containers on a terrace or in a window box. You could grow lots of herbs like basil and parsley on your window box. So gardening is even accessible for indoor gardeners, vegetable gardening, that is.
And you brought a whole bunch of things here, including basil. Now,
I did.
I often get basil at the farmer's market.
Mm-hmm.
It never smells this good. Is it because it was picked this morning?
Yeah, I have to tell you, this is from a Brooklyn garden, and it's fresh basil that I brought for you. And a couple of the people in the studio were commenting on how strong it was. It is very pungent. It was grown in Brooklyn in a community garden, and when you
keep on saying it was grown in Brooklyn. Is Brooklyn a better place to grow?
Well, I actually live in Brooklyn, and I have a couple of gardens in Brooklyn that I go to. But there are gardens all over the city. They're in the Bronx. They're in the Lower East Side. In fact, this particular one, well, actually, this tomato was by Jean Lee from Bensonhurst. This is called a Cherokee purple tomato, and it's understood this heirloom tomato was grown by the Cherokee Indians when they were on the trails. And these are heirloom varieties. That's all part of the philosophy of organic gardening, where you don't use hybrid varieties. This one, you may know, Leonard, you see it at the market quite a bit, is Brandywine.
Mm.
This goes back to the Amish, and it's from 1855, this variety.
Well, although
so it's pretty interesting.
That still has to have come from another place at some point, because tomatoes are Mesoamerican, aren't they?
Right, they are. And this particular variety is Bonnie Best, that a friend of mine, Trina Pilinari, she grows heirloom vegetables, and she recommended this one. It did pretty well. So I wanted to recommend to your listeners, if they haven't tried heirloom vegetables, they're the varieties from our great-grandparents.
Are they more difficult to grow than the kind that have been developed to be as hardy as possible?
No, actually, in fact, they're more resistant to diseases and insects. So in many ways, they're easier to grow. And you'll see them in the supermarkets and at the farmers' markets, and community gardeners grow them as well. The thing that your listeners may want to know is vegetables require at least, 10 to 12 hours of direct sunlight. And if you can't give them that amount of sunlight, then you will have problems growing them. The other thing is there are problems in the vegetable garden that a lot of the listeners may not realize. Keeping buckets of standing water around is not a good thing. And keeping your soil even tempered, picking up leaves from last year, that prevents some of the pest problems.
There's an article about you in what is this magazine?
Organic
called?
Gardening.
Organic
thank
Gardening.
You for mentioning that.
And nice picture of you too. But it says your favorite heirloom variety of tomato is the Riesentraube. Now, how do I get these? Are there places that actually sell them by seed, or do I have to buy them after they've already started?
Actually, plants? All the above. Now you could go on the web. And if you go to www.heirloomtomatoes or heirloom vegetables, there's a whole source. You could go through seed catalogs, Organic Gardening Magazine by Rodale Publishing. They often advertise organic seed companies, Seeds of Change, for instance, in New Mexico. A lot of the garden centers are promoting them. And then you can go to the farmers markets at the Union Square Market. Trina Pilinero has Silver Heights Farm, and it's all heirlooms, and she'll give you a catalog.
We should take some calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. My guest is Gerard Lordahl, director of the Open Space Greening Program for the Council on the Environment of New York City. And two calls in a row on hydrangeas. We'll start with Tony from White Plains. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Leonard. Thank you for taking my call. My husband cut all of my hydrangea bushes down to the ground 2 years ago, and they have not bloomed at all this year, just lots of beautiful leaves and no flowers. Any recommendations?
Well, I would just want to caution you to make sure that they're in a partial sun area, because a lot of times you don't get flowering on your hydrangea because of a lack of sunlight. They don't like intense sunlight, although they will wilt easily in heavy sun. The other thing is make sure you fertilize them. And when we're talking about organic gardening, I would suggest something like fish emulsion, which is byproducts of fish, and it's organic, and it gives you a fairly balanced amount of nutrients. So use some organic materials to fertilize, and that may help flower.
Now, what about cutting it down to the ground? Was that a good idea?
It's kind of a drastic thing, and a lot of people don't usually cut down their hydrangeas to the ground, that drastically. They'll go in and they'll selectively remove some of the older twigs and rejuvenate the newer twigs that are coming up so that you get some flowering from year to year. But I would recommend increasing your fertilizer and potentially some more sun for the spot.
And I'm not going to pursue this line of questioning anymore because I want Tony and her husband to get along. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Richard from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Len. My daughter has a problem with a hydrangea. She moved it, and it changed colors, the flowers.
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Your concern is, can you get the color back, I would imagine, or what is about that?
Yeah, there's some sort of game that you have to play with.
Yeah, there is. Hydrangeas are sensitive to soil acidity and alkalinity.
Yeah.
And if the soil is very acid, you'll get a blue color, and if the soil is very alkaline or basic, you'll get a pink color.
Uh-huh.
So you can go to the local garden centers and you could get different types of compost organically and add it, and that will give you the blue color because it'll make the soil more acidic. Or you could add lime, which will make the soil more basic, and you'll get that pink color.
Okay. Can I tell you a funny story about fish emulsion?
Go ahead.
If you use fish emulsion, all the neighborhood cats decide that that's the bathroom.
Well, is that true, Gerard? Is that a problem?
I don't find that. I have quite a few cats in my backyard, but you probably get them nosying in, of course, because they're wondering what the gourmet feast is. But I don't mind having my garden with cats in it. It might be a problem if you put down fish emulsion and you get a huge number of cats coming in.
But cats don't eat most of the stuff that you grow, do they?
The biggest problem with cats in gardens, people complain that they dig. And, of course, there's the health issue. You don't want feces right in the same bed where you're growing your prize carrots and radishes. But usually if you suggest a litter box somewhere nearby, the cats will prefer sand or litter to your garden.
And will they keep rodents out of your garden?
Yeah, a lot of community gardens have cats, and part of their job is to help keep mice out of the garden. It's true.
Joyce from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air. Joyce, you have to turn off your radio because there's a little bit of a delay.
Hi, let me just turn you off.
Yes.
Okay, hi. I have a small terrace, and among other things, I have two fairly large daylilies, many happy returns.
Mm-hmm.
I also have a number of snapdragon plants that I planted this year.
Mm-hmm.
And the many happy returns bloomed their heads off and have gotten rather yellow. They're kind of dying off. One of them, however, is true to its name, putting up some new flower shoots. My question is, both for them and the snapdragons, do I feed them? And if so, what do I feed them?
Okay, good question. We actually, for those listeners who don't know Happy Returns, it's a daylily variety that we actually promoted this May, and hundreds of community gardeners bought thousands of plants, and one of them was Happy Returns, the daylily. So I have it in my own backyard as well, and they're in quite a few community gardens. They're fairly medium height, about 12 to 16 inches daylilies, and they get really nice yellow flowers. They're not flowering throughout the season, but they do come back, and that's the challenge sometimes with daylilies that are not ever blooming but will bloom during periods. So like mine and yours, they bloomed earlier, and now you're getting these seed pods on the long stalks, which should be removed.
Because, I removed all
right. Those seed pods take energy from the plant. And as I said earlier, a fertilizer, I'd like to go organic. You could use manure teas, dehydrated cow manure from the garden center mixed with water. You could add that to your daylilies. You could use fish emulsion, as I said earlier. You could use compost, well-rotted compost from the garden. And anything like that would be fine. If you prefer the commercial products, there are a whole slew of things at the local home improvement centers that you could buy that have all the ingredients that you would need. for plants to have a balanced nutrition. So things like that would be fine. Dried blood can be added, et cetera.
We thank you so much for calling us, and we are going to take a little break. Come back with Gerard Lordahl at 212-433-9692 right after this. We're back with horticulturist Gerard Lordahl, who's director of the Open Space Greening Program for the Council on the Environment of New York City. And Gerard, you offer all sorts of little services and newsletters and lots of other stuff. When you first started coming here, it was a much more modest operation. Okay. That was over 20 years ago. Exactly. You've been with the Open Space Greening Program that long?
21st year, yes.
Wow.
We do. We have newsletters that are available, as you mentioned. If you go online to our website, cenyc.org, you could download our summer 2007 newsletter, and that gives your listeners information about summer gardening tips, and it talks about Farm Aid concert coming up at Randall's Island, et cetera.
And you also used to offer people a service where they could send you a cutting of some troubled plant, and you would look at it and get back to them and tell them what they might do. Are you still doing that?
Yeah, many of your listeners send us things. In fact, just last week I got a sample that was sent to me of what was poison ivy. So that's why I brought that up. Someone carefully put some poison ivy. They weren't sure if it was poison ivy, and we identified it. So be careful if you're in the garden. Leaves of three, leave them be. There are a lot of good new technologies in the pharmacy where you could put on your skin blocks that if you are going into the garden, you put this preventative block on, and then you use a wash afterwards to rinse off the oils.
But what happens if you haven't done that and you come down with poison ivy? Are there better treatments these days?
There are. There's stuff called Tecnu. I know I use Tecnu. I got it slightly this year. I try pulling out poison ivy. I usually pull it out in the wintertime. My dad usually gets it really bad, so I help pull it out in the wintertime with two pairs of gloves with a trash bag, and I remove it in the winter when it's less active. Try not to remove it in the summer because the oils will give you a rash potentially. But some got away, and I tried pulling it out recently and ended up with a slight rash. So I use the usual camphor and this stuff called Tecnu, and it worked pretty well.
Luke E. from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I have a question about growing tomatoes indoors. We have six window boxes that face east, that face west, but they're actually indoors, and we've planted two window boxes with six plants.
Right.
And we have lots of flowers, but we can't get any tomatoes. And the only tomatoes we have, we think, because a bee flew in one day, and we think it must have fertilized those
exactly.
flowers.
Exactly. The pollination is really important in gardens, and that's a question that often comes up. You mm-hmm. can't really grow tomatoes indoors without the pollinators, without full sun. You're really challenging yourself. If you can, you know, try to encourage more of those pollinators or put the tomatoes outside where they could be subjected to more sunlight. Growing them indoors is going to be a challenge. I hope it's a small cherry variety or a pear variety, because getting the large standard variety tomatoes to grow indoors is a challenge. And I hope your container is substantially large. You need at least a foot of good soil.
Okay. I think they're too shallow. We tried touching the flowers, like shaking the flowers
right.
to pollinate them, but it doesn't seem to work.
It's a little challenging, but I would suggest if you can, get them outdoors. If you have a friend who has a garden, bring them outdoors for the rest of the season, and you might be successful.
You have a fire escape?
Yes, we do, but we're worried about squirrels because we have a squirrel who goes to the fire escape a lot.
How about a rooftop? Do you have access to your rooftop? That's another option. Or
maybe
a local community garden.
Okay.
With squirrels, I mean, you could put some hardware cloth around the tomato plant to prevent the squirrel from getting in.
Okay,
well, thank you for calling us, Lukey. And I have to point out, you say tomato and I say tomato. But we're not going to call this whole thing off. Doug from Mineola. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I also say tomato, and I have a tomato question. I'm growing a particular variety of tomato this summer that's apparently well-suited towards sun drying. Mm. And I'm wondering how I go about doing that.
Right. The Roma tomatoes, I know there are a couple of Principe Borghese is another variety of tomato that's heirloom. That's really excellent for sun-dried tomatoes. But simply what you do is you harvest them when they're fully ripe and you lay them out in the sun and they will actually, you know, pretty much dehydrate on their own. You just want to make sure you don't wet them. When you harvest them, you want them to dry out. You could use some of those commercial fruit drying operations or put them in an oven under a mild temperature to speed it up. But drying the tomatoes is pretty easy, and anyone can do it. It just depends on how fast you want to do it as far as what technique you use.
Thank you so much for calling us. Dr. Longman from Bergen County, New Jersey. Longson, I'm sorry. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Dr. Audrey Longson. I'm actually calling with one question and one quick comment. I'm recently relocated from Chicago, and I'm an avid organic gardener. And I thought, you know, it would be easy. I brought several plants from my garden and planted them here in Tenafly in my new yard. And I was shocked to find all these small but significant differences that I just have, you know, I'm not sure where to really start. So, you know, from the soil to all these neat new plants I've never seen before and I don't know their names, and the temperature differences, and I'm just kind of wondering, where's a good starting point for, you know, a gardener who's been uprooted and totally unfamiliar with the area? And then the other thing I wanted to tell you is, it's kind of funny, from a medical standpoint, I've actually gotten poison ivy 5 times already this year since I've lived in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my own fault. I'm always rooting around in the woods for raspberries and stuff like that. But in Chicago, I used to get it once or twice a year, and it would be this horrendous reaction. And here in New Jersey, I'm getting it more frequently, but the reactions are really mild. It's almost as if your poison ivy is milder than Chicago. I don't know.
Interesting, or I would imagine it has something to do with personal sensitivity as well. But as far as finding out a little bit more about plants in the Northeast, there are so many books. I particularly think of Rodale Publishing's publications that are really good, and a lot of them are written geographically in mind so that they give you information for Northeast gardeners and Southwest gardeners. So I would pay attention to that. Also understand the hardy zone that we're in, and zone 6-7 is a little particular for the plants that we grow here.
But I think she was also suggesting that there is a difference in what the French call terroir. And she might very well have discovered something quite different if she'd moved to a different part of New Jersey, because the soil changes from place to place to place. And she may just very well have come upon a place which had a certain kind of a soil that was different from what she would have come upon if she'd moved to Princeton, let's say.
Right. Different geographic locations, different native soils, you know, give access to different native trees and shrubs, and you do find different types of planting. So, yeah, on Long Island with the sandy soil, you find a much different palette of plants than you do in the you know, five boroughs or even up in Westchester. So your soil has a lot to do with that as well, geographic location.
My guest is Gerard Lordahl. He's a horticulturist and a floriculturist, and he's the director of the Open Space Greening Program for the Council on the Environment of New York City. We are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Later, we will give you some email addresses and other kinds of addresses, and the address of the Open Space Greening Program in case you want to mail clippings to them. But right now, we are taking your calls. And Mario from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yeah, another call from New Jersey.
Hello.
A lot of people growing things in New Jersey?
You know, I don't know. I'm actually, you know, my mom does a lot. And you know, but I just have a question for your guest. Leonard. Oh, hi, Leonard, by the way. Long-time listener. But I just have a question for your guest. I kind of feel embarrassed asking this. Well, you know, I'm in the flower wholesale delivery business.
Mm-hmm.
And I see a lot of flowers, and I see a lot of crazy things, all kinds of stuff.
Mary, you have to get to the point. We have a lot of calls.
I'm sorry. But how can I start, like, where can I start growing?
Well, what kind of space do you have available to you, Mario? What kind of space do you have available to you?
We have a big, we have a pretty big backyard. Nothing, you know.
Yeah, the first thing you should do,
grows back there.
Like
I
said, you know,
dry.
There's lots of information available online. You know, you could just Google, you know, gardening, organic gardening magazine. The New York Times has coupons in the back for seed catalogs, and start looking through seed catalogs. Go to your local library, go online, a lot of information. Start with a sun study. Look at your yard, your community garden, your tree pit, and look at how much sun does that area get a day. If you're less than 6 hours of direct sunlight, it's considered pretty much a shade garden, and you want to go with shade flowers. Vegetables and things need at least 10 to 12 hours of direct sunlight. You want to add some evergreen diversity to your garden. So you might want shrubs that are evergreen through the winter. You might want some flower interest in some small trees like crab apples or dogwoods, and then have perennial plants that come back every year flowering through the summer like coneflower and rudbeckia, and then some seasonal interests like marigolds, geraniums, and impatiens as annuals to take you from May through to November. So, you know, that in a nutshell is a quick design thing, but there's a lot of information online in libraries, and do a sun study. Check your soil. Soil is very important. Make sure
how do you know how much acidity you have in your soil?
Yeah, you could now go to any garden center and buy a basic pH test kit. You take a tablespoon of your soil about 6 inches down, and you add indicator solutions, and that tells you whether your soil is acid or alkaline. Most flowers and vegetables like a pH that's slightly acid, about 6.5 to 6.8 on a scale of 0 to 14. And if you keep your soil at the correct pH, then all of those minerals and nutrients that are in the soil will become available to your plants.
Now, if it's particularly alkaline, are there certain plants that thrive in that?
Yeah. Certain plants prefer a more basic soil, and others, like particularly blueberries, like many gardeners know, blueberries like an acid soil. So you want to keep a soil down to 5.5 and add a lot of mulch or organic matter. That will bring the pH down. And by adding lime, you raise the pH.
We have a couple of callers who have rodent problems. So let's go to Sarah in Queens.
Oh, hello.
Yes, Sarah.
I just turned off the radio. Is that the way?
That's what you should have done, and okay. we're doing well. What's
okay.
the question?
We have a lawn, and every summer we get holes, obviously dug by something, you know, in the back. Regularly, they come back and do the same holes year in and year out. And we've tried, I think, dried blood, and we also have a cat, which we thought might, you know, frighten away some small animals, but the holes are back, and it ruins the lawn. We don't have it in the front for some reason, but we have it in the back. They come back to their old places.
Okay, well, small ridges and mounds in lawns is usually indicative of mole problems. And there are have a heart mole traps that some people use. There are organic repellents that you could get from places like Gardens Live that will keep moles away. You're talking about holes. So I'm thinking, you know, like we said earlier, we were alluding to rodent damage. Rodents do burrow. We see them all over the place. And that could be a problem. I would suggest you call a commercial exterminator and see. You want to try and identify the burrows of those animals, if it's a rat or mice or depending on the size of the hole. Sometimes that's how people can tell what kind of rodent it is. But it doesn't sound like it's a mole, which is usually common in lawns because they're usually ridges and mounds where moles burrow under the lawn. So my guess is rodents, and then you have some trapping you can do or some, you know, some people don't want to go to poisoning.
We thank you for your call. Georgina from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a container garden on our rooftop in Williamsburg, and I have two questions related to that. We had a bit of an aphid problem earlier, and we got it under control with a soap spray, but we heard that ladybugs were a good solution, and we couldn't track down ladybugs, and since they're living organisms, they're actually kind of complicated to to have shipped. So I was wondering if you could suggest where you get ladybugs in the city.
Yeah, sure. There's a variety of ladybugs that's trademarked by Gardens Alive. It's called Stay Home Ladybugs. And the problem is sometimes when people buy ladybugs through the mail, as soon as they release them, they fly to another space and don't stay in your garden. The reason for that is ladybugs are looking for food. What they do with the stay-at-home ladybugs is they feed them right before they ship them, so they're not anxious to fly away. So go to gardensalive.com.
And we are going to sneak in a call here, but you have to make it very quick, Monica.
Okay, hi. My roses are drooping as if they are very, very sad, the actual blossoms, before they really are done blossoming. And I'm wondering if it's because of the heat and what I can do about it. They're adequately watered.
There could be a problem with the soil. You say it's adequately watered. Sometimes if there's not enough air circulation in the soil, you'll get that drooping to the bud. So make sure your soil is well drained.
It is.
Sort of ironic. You want water, but you want the water to drain away from the roots. Because remember, roots need to breathe also in a sense. They need to have gas exchange under the ground. So you don't want it constantly sitting in water. Check to see, is the water not draining through in the container?
I think it's draining through because we have what's called bank run here. It's a very sandy, I'm on Long Island, it's a very sandy, porous soil.
Then if you're on Long Island and sandy soil, I would say try mulching the rose. It might be an issue of losing the water. The tips dry out first and it might cause the drooping.
Okay, thank you so much.
And we thank you for your call. A listener from New Jersey said that Master Gardeners of Somerset, I think, named another
extension.
Town as well, has heirloom tomatoes. And I'm sure there are other places all around the area that do, where you can get these things. I'm so thrilled to see heirloom tomatoes and heirloom potatoes, which must be harder to grow in this area. But still, we're seeing a lot of them at the farmer's market.
Yeah, and if you'd like, I'll leave you with this Brandywine heirloom tomato.
Oh,
it's delicious.
Boy.
It's almost 1 pound.
And gorgeous, too. Gerard Lordahl is the director of the Open Space Greening Program, the Council on the Environment of New York City. The email address again?
Yes, if you go to our website, cenyc.org, and my email address is plantlot, plantlot, at aol.com. You could also call us at 212-788-7923, and we could send you our newsletter through the mail as well.
And people can mail things to 51 Chamber Street, room 228. The zip there is 10007. We'll put all of that on our website at some point. As always, Gerard, it's been a great pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you, Len. It's always good to be here.